Our next speaker is Daniel Dorfman from George Mason University, where he is a PhD candidate in neuroscience. And his presentation will delve into some truly amazing new technologies that allow precise tinkering with brain circuitry. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah,
yeah, tinkering. I like that word.
Tinkering.
Yes. Thank you.
All right, thank you for that introduction and for attending this talk. So I titled my abstract specific to optogenetics, which is a new technique for neuromodulation. But I wanted to make the talk a little more broad at first, so I'm just going to begin by talking about neuromodulation in general, some of its technological advances, and some of their ethical implications, and then go ahead and focus on optogenetics specifically. So to begin with, what actually do I mean by what is neuromodulation? For my purposes for this talk, I'm referring to artificially induced changes in brain activity, such as can be done by pharmacology, drugs, medicinal or otherwise, electrical, which is invasive or non-invasive. So this diagram here is a diagram of deep brain stimulation with implanted electrodes deep into the brain, which is often done as a treatment for Parkinson's disease for severe symptoms. And then finally, I'll talk about optogenetic neuromodulation. But there is also normal neuromodulation in the brain. So things that modulate the brain, coffee, music, reading. If you have a functioning brain, your brain is modulating itself, the environment is modulating your brain. So as we get to the point of thinking about the ethics, simply the idea of neuromodulation is not a dangerous idea, but thinking about how we do it artificially or in an interacting way is an important question to consider. So here's an example of some natural neuromodulation. In this study, subjects were asked to participate in a gratitude letter writing exercise, and those subjects who wrote a letter expressing gratitude exhibited both greater gratitude and greater neuromodulation 3 months after the fact. So that's just one little example of many, many different studies that look at the way the brain is modulated by so many different things. So to begin with an overview of some neuromodulation technologies, there are a few different ways to non-invasively stimulate or modulate the brain. These are approved generally for human use. So for electrical methods, there is both transcranial direct current stimulation, which directly applies current to the scalp. Through electrodes, there's also transcranial magnetic stimulation, which uses a magnetic coil close to the head, and the coil can create inductive currents inside the brain. These electrical methods, however, are generally low. They have low spatial precision. They can't really target a very specific brain region, and they generally have low power. They don't have a lot of effectiveness. And there have been some studies looking at comparing the effects of these kinds of modulation to placebo effects, and the effect size is usually fairly small. There's also, of course, pharmacology, which faces the issues of side effects of being very non-spatial. You can't target any certain brain region. If drugs get to the brain, they diffuse anywhere and can bind to any part of the brain where they have a receptor. And then there's also the major issue of the blood-brain barrier, which prevents a lot of drugs from crossing into the brain. There also are some invasive methods for neuromodulation, and these are often done only as surgical intervention for severe psychiatric or neurological disorders, such as depression or Parkinson's disease, or in the case of brain surgery to treat severe epilepsy. During surgery, they have to map out which brain regions, which cells can be safely removed, so they often will conduct experiments with patients' consent for that. But this is highly invasive. In this example of invasive neuromodulation, you can see the electrodes implanted in the brain here. And this is a study that was looking at the effect of implanting electrodes into a region of the brain called the nucleus accumbens, which is a brain region important for reward, for motivation. It's also implicated in addiction. It's a dopamine center in the brain and is involved in desire. And what they found in using invasive deep brain stimulation to treat very severe depression was that stimulation of the nucleus accumbens could rapidly trigger euphoria in depressed subjects. So this graph here is just showing a psychometric score of happiness versus the voltage of the stimulation, and the black line is showing the subject's reported happiness. And the quotes from this article refer to the subject saying that it felt like getting high, like being totally relaxed and easy. And then as the voltage increased, the subject started to feel, say it felt great, but maybe too much. And they also tracked anxiety, this gray trace. So before stimulation, it was high, and then as stimulation increased, anxiety dropped, and then went back up again. So this is just kind of illustrating the kind of really profound effects that directly stimulating the brain can have on the cognitive and emotive behavior of a patient. So this starts to bring up some ethical issues and questions, such as would increasing happiness in normal individuals be acceptable if someone so desired? And what is the line between therapeutic and use versus enhancement? So now to move to specifically optogenetics. Optogenetics is basically stimulating the brain using light, using fiber optics. So this video is showing optogenetics in a mouse. And you can see right now, the light is not on. Now it turns on, the little blue dot on the head of the mouse there. So now it's off again. And when it turns on, it's stimulating the motor cortex on one side of the brain. So it's just running in circles because that's the side of the brain being stimulated. And so this technique, optogenetics, is overcoming limitations of traditional electrical or pharmacological approaches to neuromodulation. It can really achieve very, very high spatial and temporal precision on the scale of single, individual, or tens of neurons can be stimulated, and they can be stimulated at physiological rates. Now, just to compare that to even the deep brain invasive stimulation is stimulating brain tissue on the scale of millimeters. A cubic millimeter of the brain has estimated 50,000 neurons in it. So the ability to really zoom in spatially on tens of neurons is a big advancement in terms of the scientific progress of understanding the brain. And so we can also achieve with optogenetics distributed stimulation of multiple brain circuits, where you can't do that with electrical stimulation because every site you want to stimulate has to have implanted electrodes. However, this is a very, very highly invasive technique. You have to implant an optical fiber into the rodent brain. It's definitely not approved for human use, likely will not be for a long time, but it's hard to predict. And it also requires genetic tools. So how does it work? Optogenetics has basically exploded in the field of neuroscience in the last 12 to 15 years. And the discovery was made by by engineering this protein. So there's a light-sensitive protein in algae. The protein is an ion channel that opens in response to blue light. So blue light will cause the channel to open, and ions can cross into the cell. This is the same way the brain works. Neurons have ion channels that cause voltage to propagate down neurons and communicate with other neurons. So this gene was taken from this algae, from protein, and inserted. The DNA was inserted into specific neurons of the brain, and now neurons can have their activity modulated just by flashing blue pulses of light with a laser. And there are lots of methods and techniques being developed to specifically target certain brain cells or brain regions. The general method of targeting optogenetics to the brain involves viral injection. So you can directly inject a virus to a brain region of interest, as is shown here, region B. And then that injection can lead to opsin expression. Opsin is the optically activated protein throughout this region B, and then by stimulating that region with fiber optic, you can activate those neurons that project to other neurons in the brain. You can also be more selective by combining the viral injection with some kind of recombinase or promoter-dependent opsin, and so that now when you're injecting into region B, only those specific neurons within that region that have the correct expressing recombinase or promoter will then express the ion channel. So this allows you to target very specific populations. There are many different types of brain cells in the brain, and in any certain region there are different cells performing different tasks. So the ability to target, say, excitatory versus inhibitory neurons can really allow very, very precise manipulation of brain activity. And more recent developments are leading to even higher precision ways to optically target these opsins into the brain. So previously, optogenetic proteins were expressed throughout the entire cell of a neuron, so the cell body and all of the dendrites. So you can focus a light onto a single cell, but you would still be activating dendritic processes of neighboring neurons and activating multiple neurons. So a recent development published just 2017, these scientists developed a cell body targeted opsin which limits the expression of the optically activated protein ion channel just to the cell body and not to the dendritic processes. So even higher single cell resolution can be obtained. Another interesting development is looking at ways to remove the need for having an invasive fiber optic cable going into the brain. This is a schematic, and it's illustrating an idea of how this could possibly eventually be used in humans, but this is not approved for human use or close to that. But just published this year was a technique that involved inserting nanoparticles into the brain, which the nanoparticle, illustrated here, converts infrared light or near infrared light into blue or visible light, which is the light wave necessary for activating these optogenetic proteins. And so near-infrared light can penetrate the brain even from outside the scalp, whereas blue light does not penetrate well. So this would allow having an optical source outside the brain, or at least not deeply implanted, and could lead to future developments in terms of non-invasive stimulation. So optogenetic neuromodulation and several different experiments that I'm going to kind of just give an overview of here can really... It shows sophisticated control over rodent behavior. So there are some specific experiments that looked at evaluating memory in rodents using optogenetics. So in one experiment looking at manipulating memory, neurons can be tagged in the brain of the rodent with optogenetically. So cells that are active during the learning experience are the ones tagged with the optically activated protein. And then if those cells are then, the cells that were tagged with the protein are then activated by shining the light on them, the experiments have shown that the memory can be recalled. Or in contrast, if you activate optogenetic proteins that actually inhibit neuron firing, some experiments have shown ways that the memory can be suppressed. So one specific experiment here looked at just how optogenetic stimulation can evoke memory recall. So first, as a definition, the memory engram is a sparse group of neurons which are collectively activated during the formation or retrieval of a memory. And so for this experiment, neurons were genetically labeled during a fear learning, which consisted of a minor foot shock in a certain context that in a normal experiment, a rat or a mouse would associate that context with the foot shock, and then the next time they were in that context, they would freeze out of fear, even though they weren't shocked later. So the very same neurons were then later reactivated optogenetically with the mouse in a different context, so a context that would not normally evoke fear. However, the mice then increased fearful freezing in the new context. So this is a video from this experiment. And the light's off now, but when you see the light come on, you'll see the mouse's behavior in terms of fearful expression, freezing and things, increase. It kind of darts around the box there, looking to hide in the corner, freezing. And then another experiment published in 2013, these scientists used optogenetic manipulation to essentially induce a false memory in a mouse. So first, neurons which are involved in spatial navigation and spatial memory, they were optically targeted in mice, but their expression in those neurons only occurs in this white region called off box. So when the mice are on the drug labeled docs here. They don't express it, so they will only express these proteins in this period. Then, optogenetic labeling was allowed to occur in this off-docs period only while mice were in this context A with the red triangle. Next, the mice were fear conditioned in a different context, B, while simultaneously activating neurons with light, illustrated here, that had been labeled in context A. Then mice were tested in either A or in a novel context C to see if the pairing of optical stimulation of A with context B would associate a fear memory in context A. So in a normal experiment, without optogenetics, the mouse would not exhibit fear in context A or C, only in B. But here they're testing to see if it will also occur in A due to the pairing of the activation during the shock of neurons that have been active in learning context A. And so these are the results. And the mice only exhibited freezing behavior when tested in context A, illustrated with the blue bars here, and only when they had been optogenetically stimulated during the fear conditioning of context B. So this illustrates how artificial activation during context A, activation of these engram cells during fear conditioning, can associate a fear memory with context A, even though the mouse was never foot shocked in context A. So that's implanting a false memory, in a sense, in a mouse. And finally, one other experiment that's quite interesting that I'd like to give an overview of is this one looking at optogenetic manipulation to suppress a cocaine-conditioned place preference in mice. So this kind of research is done. It's an important way to study addiction. Normally, mice, if they learn a cocaine-conditioned place preference, then they learn to associate receiving cocaine in one place and not another, so they will always prefer the place where they have the cocaine, even after the cocaine is removed. So in this experiment, during the pretest phase, illustrated here, mice could freely explore these two chambers, the square or the box. And this is the tagged optogenetically row, this is the control row. So no difference between the control and the optogenetic here. And you can see the trajectory, the two-dimensional trajectory of the mouse, and you can see they're spending time about the same in both the square or the circular spaces. Then, cocaine was provided in whichever chamber the specific mouse did not prefer initially, even though their preference was pretty even overall. And then, in test one, mice were tested to see if they had a preference for the cocaine chamber, which is illustrated now with a circle. And indeed, both groups spend much more of their trajectory in the cocaine chamber, even though they're no longer receiving the cocaine there. The tagged mice, then received optogenetic inhibition during chamber exploration between test one and test two, and then were retested. And in test two, mice which received the inhibition, shown right on the top, had lost their conditioned place preference, but the control mice had not. And this is illustrated on this axis here. The tagged optogenetically inhibited mice restored their cocaine place preference to no preference. So that suggests ways that optogenetic stimulation can specifically modulate an addiction memory and possibly give ideas or lead to future developments about treating addiction in the future. Lastly, in terms of optogenetics in human trials, I said optogenetics in the human brain is far, far off at this point, but there is some recent clinical trials looking at using these optically activated proteins to treat retinitis pigmentosa, which is a disease that causes blindness by it kills photoreceptors in the retina. So here's the retina here, the photoreceptors. Here's the front of the eye where light comes in. And so this disease leads to blindness by killing the photoreceptors, which are the only light-activated cells naturally in the human eye. And so clinical trials are underway to inject an optogenetic protein to retinal ganglion cells, which are upstream from the photoreceptors. So light normally hits the photoreceptors, activates these other other cells leading to the optic nerve pathway into the brain. So clinical trials are underway to inject optogenic proteins into these retinal ganglion cells to restore some degree of light sensitivity to the visual system. And injection into the eye poses significantly lower risk factors in the brain. It doesn't require any kind of fiber optic light source. These clinical trials, I think, are underway as of in the past year or so. I'm not sure what the results are yet or when they'll be made available. But it's some interesting and possibly effective use to treat blindness using these proteins. However, the use in the human brain is not yet in sight. So what are some of the ethical considerations to think about in terms of optogenetics? And it's not yet in sight to be used in the human brain, but with the developments down the road, it's important to start thinking now about what sort of ethical considerations we should be thinking about. So here are just some of my thoughts on it. So safety is, of course, a big concern. Risks of injection, risks of inserting a fiber optic light source. We have to think about the long-term efficacy. There's not a lot of research in rodents looking at how long mice and rats can live and thrive with optogenetic stimulation. And side effects are pretty much as of yet unknown, so lots of more research is required to establish safety. And then there are also technical barriers that would have to be overcome for effective use. One of the major barriers is that the fiber optic light source to the brain produces a lot of heat. The heat damages tissue, so there's a limit to how much light can actually be used in the brain. In contrast, we can also think about some of the potential benefits. So it's possible, given the state of research now, that optogenetics or some other form of precise neuromodulation could lead to more effective treatments for PTSD, for depression, epilepsy, Parkinson's, a multitude of neurological and psychiatric disorders, and thereby reduce human suffering. Important questions that come up, however, as we think about the ethical considerations are questions of enhancement of healthy populations, memory, mood, etc. Would it be ethical for anyone to choose to enhance their memory or their mood? And questions come up like, where is the line between treating pathology versus enhancement? That's a very fuzzy line. Then, of course, protecting against malicious misuse and protecting, and also the question of, should memory be manipulated in treatment of pathology? So this gets, even if it's a treatment of a pathology, it's a therapeutic use, it's not an enhancement. What do we think about human memory being modulated, say, if we could make someone forget their traumatic experience that was causing their PTSD? That really strikes at what it means to be human, and so that raises a lot of concerns. There are some lessons as we think about optogenetics and ethics that come from deep brain stimulation. There have been ethical analyses of deep brain stimulation. So this report looked at patients who had received deep brain stimulation following for Parkinson's disease, I believe. And different patients have a wide range of experiences. So one patient said that the disease had been part of him, and he also said that he thought deep brain stimulation changed him. But he didn't think it changed his personality or who he or she was and how they felt about themselves. In contrast, another patient said that DBS has not changed who I am, but it's improved. But another patient has said, you know, I can't be the real me anymore, I can't pretend. I think that I felt that the person that I have been since the intervention was somehow observing somebody else, but it wasn't me. I feel like I am who I am now, but it's not the me that went into the surgery that time. And my family says that they grieve for the old me. So as we think about these sorts of treatments in neuromodulation, whether optogenetic or any form of neuromodulation that can lead to precise modulation of cognitive and emotional behaviors, we have to think about the range of human experience and the ways that the human brain in any individual is unique. And so these ethical questions arise in terms of thinking about how to treat individuals and not just looking at the science across populations. So just to close with some Christian-specific considerations. As Christians, we ought to think about serving both the individual and the common good and holding those in balance. as of the plenary this morning, so well articulated. And we have to think about avoiding the injustice that could come with misuse, or the injustice of enhancement being only for the privileged, while at the same time caring for and treating the suffering. So balancing those aspects of the ethical concerns. And then lastly, we should think of human will as a gift from God, a reflection of his image in us. And so to the degree that modulation could be helpful to individuals in restoring their will or autonomy in neurological conditions, it could be seen as a positive, whereas if it's actually affecting their will, maybe reducing their ability to choose, then it's a major ethical concern. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Seeing the mouse run in circles, it's sort of disturbing.
It is.
Over here.
I was wondering if you ever use CRISPR technology to incorporate the off-syncoding genes, and if that's being done, at what level in development is it done?
So it was a question about if CRISPR is being used in the development of the genetic insertion of the optically activated genes. And it's not something I'm specifically working on and very familiar with. I know that in terms of developing transgenic mice that express these proteins, I think it has been done recently. It is being done. It's not the most common way still. Usually it's viral injection. So. Yeah.
So are there, the list of bioethics that you listed at the end, are there any that are just specific to, is it
optogenetics?
Optogenetics. That's not specific to things like pharmaceuticals. Like, is there something that we should be more upset about with optogenetics as opposed to, pharmaceuticals?
So the question was about pharmaceuticals can have the same ethical concerns in terms of enhancement versus treatment, and relating that to optogenetic specific. I think the ethical concerns are very similar by and large. One of the important questions that is emerging, though, is that optogenetic manipulation might be able to achieve much higher precision and therefore much greater effects on cognition or emotion than pharmaceuticals have been able to show. But the ethical concerns are definitely similar and can learn from each other.
I wonder, maybe a final question. The precision is the key with this, how precisely individual neurons can be targeted. And are people finding, how the brain works is the enormous big question that people really don't know in detail how it works. Do you feel like this technology might lend us to learn more about specifically how the brain works? Is that your hope?
One of the major uses in terms of just studying using optogenetics in rodents in basic neuroscience research is just to understand how it works. And there's still a lot we don't know. So there's a lot of research just looking at how memory works and how it's distributed across populations of cells and the ways they communicate with each other. So it's
encoding memories and things like
encoding and recall. So the optogenetics are a big resource just to basic neuroscience in rodents, even if they're not useful for humans. Yes.
I had a question just to expand on that, but your precision doesn't help you much if you don't know
what
your target is. And as a corollary a little bit to the human genome and CRISPR's, so the brain is complex and hard to understand how it works. So how close are we to learning or understanding sections of the brain and what areas we would actually choose a target and how to make it
Yeah, there's a long ways to go in terms of understanding the brain, so the precision is not very useful without knowing where to target. But there is a lot being learned in terms of different forms of memory, how they're included in certain populations of brain cells, And like these studies that I just give an overview of have shown that if you reactivate the cells associated with memory, you can evoke the same behavior that occurred during natural recall of memory. So there's a lot of research being done, a lot being learned, and a lot still to learn.
Well, thank you to all three speakers and for all of you for being here. I believe next on the agenda is lunch, is that right?